That sound you hear, most economists say, is at the root of all inflation. It is a rotary printing press, turning out United States currency at the Bureau of Engraving in Washington. This press is printing money to replace torn and worn bills that have been taken out of circulation. However, sometimes it is used to increase our money supply. And when that increase in money is significantly higher than the production of goods and services in our economy, the result, sooner or later, is inflation.
The sound of money, the lovely sound of money, I find it quite appealing, a feeling you may share.
Inflation nowadays, it seems there's so little left to save after you make your basic expenses of living and food and clothing that it's almost an impossible situation.
When you go in the stores, you get nothing for your money. Everything has gone up terrific. The clothing, food.
I have stopped buying more expensive cuts of meat that I always had bought before because I can't, I cannot pay the higher prices of steak and lamb chops and those items anymore.
By calling on some of the leading economists of the nation, we will explore the cause, effect, and possible cure of an inflation that has created some major and painful dislocations in our country.
Inflation, the economic plague.
The U.S. Labor Department's most recent figures on inflation show the cost of living rose 6.2% in the last year, the sharpest increase since the Korean War. What sort of a priority has the Nixon administration given its fight on inflation?
Don't ever underestimate the determination of this administration to lick inflation. If you said to me, what is the most important national policy of the United States today? From the viewpoint of the Nixon administration, I would say to you, inflation. And I would put, surprisingly, withdrawal from Vietnam second.
That was Dr. Pierre Renfray, who has counseled President Nixon on economic matters. But what are Mr. Nixon's own feelings about the cause of inflation?
The rate of inflation in 1969 was greater than in any other year in the decade. But what happens in any particular year is not a result of the policy of that year. It is caused by what was done prior to that time. And for 5 years prior to 1969, this nation, by going into debt to the tune of $57 billion, planted the inflationary seeds which grew into almost an uncontrollable situation in 1969. Now, starting in 1969, and again in 1970, and again in 1971, we have balanced budgets. That kind of policy, we believe, will turn it around. It is the best way to turn it around, and the only effective way.
The Nixon administration has used a double-barreled approach in trying to restrain the economy and stop inflation. It cut government spending and continued the surtax. This is called fiscal restraint. Then, the independent Federal Reserve slowed the rate at which it was creating money. By mid-1969, the money supply, which had been increasing at the rate of 7%, stopped growing. Under the law of supply and demand, this made money scarce and expensive to borrow. There are economists who believe that squeezing off the money supply is the best way to control inflation. They are called monetarists. Perhaps their most articulate spokesman is Dr. Milton Friedman, professor of economics at the University of Chicago.
Mr. Friedman, what do you think is the principal cause of inflation?
The principal cause of inflation is the creation of too much money. And by money, I mean literal money, the kind of green pieces of paper you carry in your pocket, plus the deposits to your credited banks. That whenever the quantity of money in that sense goes up more rapidly than the quantity of goods and services available to buy, you tend to have inflation. And in fact, in thousands of years of history, there is no example of an inflation of any significant magnitude which has not been produced by too rapid an increase in the quantity of money. Now, I have always said, we will not have another Great Depression until we first had a great inflation. I can well believe that if, in the course of the next 20 or 30 years, we were to have a great inflation, a real inflation, not the kind of thing we've been having, but one in which prices doubled and tripled every year, that this would produce a situation which would make possible at that time a mistake in the other direction of a Great Depression. But at the moment, I think we're reasonably safe.
Our worst inflations have been byproducts of war. Wars are financed by printing money. Full wartime employment puts that money in the pockets of workers with an urge to spend, while the factories produce armaments, not refrigerators. Bidding for the available consumer goods and services pushes prices upward. Dr. Paul Samuelson, professor of economics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, believes our current inflation troubles began in 1965 at the height of the Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War exacerbates every economics problem. It causes our balance of payments problem to be worse. It causes our inflation problem to be worse. In fact, the major cause of our present inflation is the fact that in 1965, President Johnson, in my judgment, tried to put across the Vietnam War quietly and by stealth on the American people without daring to ask for taxes, as some of us new economists had asked him to do. And therefore, it makes me extremely happy to be on the side of the angels and to be able to say that everything in old-fashioned economics, everything in modern new economics, everything even in Friedman new economics says this is a losing proposition. Let's get out of it.
So wars help create inflation. And one of history's worst occurred in Germany after World War I. From 1921 to 1923, wholesale prices rose more than a trillion times. Inflation rose so fast that people dining out paid their restaurant bills in advance because there was a chance their meal would double in price while they were eating. As for mortgages, the total of all mortgages outstanding in Germany amounted to about $10 billion in American dollars in 1913. 10 years later, as the German mark was ravaged by inflation and became almost worthless, you could have paid off all those mortgages with one American penny. This inflation, of course, helped create the conditions that brought Hitler to power. Inflation psychology says prosperity is guaranteed in our controlled economy, therefore buy it now before prices go any higher. Of course, the theory is father to the event.
If you suddenly found out tomorrow that you were going to inherit a fortune in 3 years, I feel sure you'd step up your personal expenditures and you'd probably save less out of your salary. And if you didn't, your wife would make you. Now, it's a little bit like that for the whole American people if they feel assured of a rosy, prosperous future. They spend more, they borrow more, they save less. Businessmen build up their plant faster than they need to because they know that 3 years and 5 years from now they can sell anything they can produce. They borrow to do it. This is the stuff that inflation is made of.
That was Sidney Homer, one of Wall Street's most astute financial analysts. The term credibility gap has often been used when talking about government pronouncements about Vietnam. Now it's being used more and more frequently to describe the Nixon administration's stance on inflation. For example, the administration has made budget cuts in the areas of health, education, and welfare on grounds that the higher figures were inflationary. Yet the president shelved the recommendations of his cabinet-level oil import control study, which recommended changes in the oil import quotas that could have saved a penny or more a gallon on gasoline and heating oils. This inconsistency does not go unnoticed by corporation budget planners. Again, Pierre Rinfrae.
We have just completed a survey of industries' intentions to spend money on new plant and equipment in 1970. And that is, incidentally, the most important demand for money. And the results of that survey are shocking. It shows that American industry in 1970 says, and this was from February 1 until February 21, this survey shows a gain of 12.5% in capital investment in 1970, which is much higher than anybody now anticipates. And that means they're going to have to borrow you know, billions in the open market. I sit on a couple of boards of companies, and we went around the table a month ago on whether or not we should cut our capital investment. And we asked 14 members, and every one of them there virtually gave the same answer. Why should we cut? It's going to cost us 6% more next year, and 6% more the year after that, and 6% more the year after that. And if we believe in the fundamental strength of the American economy, that the trend is up, let's spend it now because it's going to cost more in 2 years. And I must say, incidentally, that's exactly the advice I give all my industrial clients.
The Federal Reserve policy of tight money to curb rising prices has, of course, created high interest rates. The purpose is to slow the growth in spending with borrowed money and thus bring total spending in line with the near-capacity output of goods and services. However, Congressman Wright Patman, chairman of the House Banking Committee, doesn't believe that higher interest rates can stop inflation.
Whenever you raise interest rates, the housewife finds out on her next visit to her local grocery store, prices have raised. Whenever you increase interest rates, you raise all prices immediately. That's inflationary. That's what you call inflation. So it's just as illogical to say that you would increase interest rates to stop or deter inflation as it would be to say that to use gasoline to put out a fire instead of water. If we don't roll back interest rates, we'll be going right into a bad depression. And there's no way to stop it. And we'll just have everything against us. And this country will take it years to get back. We'll probably not only have a bad depression, but a dictatorship would be possible. This is going to be rough.
Congressman Patman recalls the Great Depression in the 30s, when inflation was stopped cold. The stock market crash deflated our economy severely, and all prices dropped sharply.
Potatoes are cheaper, tomatoes are cheaper, now's the time to fall in love. Why, the butcher, the baker, the old candlestick maker, gave their price a downward shove.
Yes, prices were cheaper then, much cheaper. But no one seemed to have any money, as the economy almost came to a halt. Unemployment rose to 25%. Today, if any administration allowed our economy to become that depressed, social unrest might turn into social upheaval. So, in the light of the economic devastation that occurred in the 30s, there's some wisdom in Milton Berle's observation about inflation. He said, "Your money won't buy as much as it would have during the Depression, but then you didn't have any." The Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington keeps tabs on how much food prices are rising each month. The figures show a startling comparison in prices for some food staples in January 1965, when the inflationary spiral started, as compared to January 1970, 5 years later. In January 1965, butter was 76 cents a pound. January 1970, 86 cents a pound. In January 1965, milk, 24 cents a quart. In 1970, 29 cents a quart. In January 1965, eggs, 52 cents a dozen. In 1970, 79 cents a dozen. In January 1965, choice grade hamburger, 49 cents a pound. In 1970, 65 cents a pound. In January 1965.
Every time I go, I pay more, I get less. I haven't found any way yet to talk my kids out of three meals a day, minimum. They'd prefer six to eight. This costs money. And I'd like steak and roast, but we more often get stew meat.
Inflation hurts the retired and elderly people of this nation more than any other group. Every time the cost of living goes up, it steals money from those people who live on fixed incomes, pensions, and insurance policies.
I have a little bit of savings, but every time I have a plumbing bill or have something extra, I have to go into what little savings I've got, and it don't last long the way I do. You want to know the way I do my business? I deposit my pension check and pay my bills, and I eat on what's left.
That's how Mrs. Florida Baggett, a 76-year-old widow, copes with inflation in Pensacola, Florida. In Denver, Colorado, Mrs. Rose West is among the growing legion of housewives who regard the inflation fight as a challenge to their ingenuity.
Rose, what are you doing as a person to combat the inflationary problems that you run into?
Well, I have the most erratic shopping pattern that you've ever seen. I don't shop like anybody else anymore. My habits have very definitely changed. I buy a half a beef at a time for two people in my family. In the spring and in the summer, I go to the farms. I get my fresh fruits, my vegetables, I put them up myself. When you've done this once, you realize how much you're paying for the carton and the wrapping that's wrapped around that little minute bit of food that you get. I know that everybody can't do this. This isn't feasible for everybody. But for me, it's an answer. Now, just eggs. I won't buy my eggs at the store. I'll just be darned if I'm going to pay that price for them. I go to a place where they grow eggs and buy them there. I get them for 45 cents a dozen.
Inflation does not spare the more affluent members of society either. Mrs. J. Fred Close is a Baltimore mother of six with a summer home on Maryland's East Shore.
I have stopped buying more expensive cuts of meat that I always had probably bought before. Of course, naturally, I want to buy a cut that will give us a good meal, if not possibly a leftover, such as a roast. I buy a pork roast and try to allow enough leftover for maybe pork chow mein the following night, so that I do have to have a fairly good size piece of meat, and I try to find it on sale because I can't I cannot pay the higher prices of steak and lamb chops and those items anymore.
In San Diego, California, housewives have found a way of beating the high cost of living by going south of the border. Individually or in carpools, they drive 15 or more miles to Tijuana, Mexico, where all prices are cheaper, including gasoline. Clyde Martin in San Diego speaks to Mrs. Joyce Stegman, wife of a school official who travels to Mexico regularly to take advantage of low-cost services.
I've started my whole neighborhood. We all go down. We go down in a carpool for our hair. The beauty shops in San Diego run around $4 for a shampoo and set. They are $1.25 in Tijuana. And the most that you tip the girls down there would be a quarter.
What prompted you into going down to Tijuana to even consider making purchases of food articles?
Well, I just thought I'd go down and try it. We had spent some time in Mexico, and I thought the filet mignons were so good that I started going down to buy mine in Tijuana.
How much per pound do you spend in Tijuana for filet mignon?
I would say that since they run in kilos, you have to figure a kilo is approximately 2 pounds. And this is about $2 a kilo, so you're picking it up for about $1 a pound in American money and American pound.
Do you really save anything going down to Tijuana making purchases like this?
Oh, absolutely. But when you go down, you buy a lot. You don't go down just for one thing. I mean, you're going to spend the morning down there. Maybe you're going to end up having lunch, and you make it a fun day.
One way to beat inflation is to look for higher interest rates on your money. And more people today are doing this than ever before in this country. Financial institutions, pension funds, and insurance companies used to be the biggest buyers of bonds. Now, it's individuals seeking a higher return than their savings accounts can pay. This trend became most apparent in January, when savings banks reported record withdrawals and mutual savings banks experienced the first net outflow of funds in their history. Some of this money is being reinvested in Treasury notes by ordinary citizens, like those who line up at the Federal Reserve Bank near Wall Street to cash in on the higher interest rates.
When you go in the stores, you get nothing for your money. Everything has gone up. It's terrific. I am on Social Security, and my husband goes out in June, and we do want to have some income that we can live. And we can't do it on just the bank interest, so we want to see how this helps us.
I feel it in my own practice as an architect, seeing the cost of construction going completely out of bounds. I find that the same situation reflects in every phase of our existence, in whatever we purchase, whatever we attempt to do. So I hope that this investment here will help.
Inflation nowadays, it seems there's so little left to save after you make your basic expenses of living and food and clothing that it's almost an impossible situation. It's getting a little frustrating. That's why I'm currently looking for a high interest rate with little I have left.
As people draw their money out of savings accounts for a higher return, the banks, already squeezed by tight money, have less money for mortgages. And this is one reason why housing is in the doldrums. In Washington, Lewis Barber, president of the National Association of Home Builders, speaks about the problem.
It's been a matter of administration policies, not only the present, but in the past, to limit the production of housing on the basis that, often on the basis, that housing is inflationary. As far as I'm concerned, nothing could be further from the truth. It is the limiting policies that cause housing prices to go up, because if we had a constant supply availability of funds for housing, I don't think we would have seen housing costs go up as high as they have. And certainly the lack of housing has been one of the reasons that prices have gone up so terribly much in the past year and a half or so.
Barber was asked if the prices of houses would come down as inflation slowed.
Today's house is probably the best buy we're ever going to see in our lifetime. And that applies to housing that has started now or this spring or this summer. Because there are a number of built-in factors that makes it impossible for the price of the house to come down. For instance, lumber prices are bound to increase as soon as housing starts move up, unless the Congress does something about it. We're in for a shortage of lumber. Land prices continue to accelerate year after year. Your built-in labor costs, contracts, over the next 3 years call for better than a 25% increase in labor costs. And the productivity has not gone up to compensate for those costs.
Inflation is weakening our educational system. Teachers' salaries have more than kept pace with rising prices, but the extra wage and building costs brought on by inflation have plunged the cities into a financial crisis and placed a heavy burden on the property taxpayer. Some impoverished school districts are faced with the dismal prospect of closing classes before the school year ends or dropping some programs altogether. Interscholastic sports programs are among the first victims of inflation-caused budget cuts. But even more destructive is inflation's corroding effect on the school building program.
We feel we need about a 20% increase in the total plant, educational plant in America. And most of the construction comes as a result of local bond issues. And over the last 2 years, about 50% of these bond issues have failed. Some people call it a taxpayer's revolt. I think it has to do with a local tax, property tax dollar. And the interesting thing, of the 50% that have passed, only about half of the bonds have been sold. The interest rates are so high now that the bonding people, the people that buy bonds, won't buy the school bonds because they aren't paying enough. They can invest their money at 8, 9, 10, 12% elsewhere, and school bonds last year reached a peak of 6.6% interest. We think that something has to be done about this if we're going to sell these bonds so we can continue to build schools.
That was George Fisher, president of the National Education Association. There are two graphic terms, if you can use that word anywhere when dealing with economics, that describe the inflation virus. They are demand pull and cost push types of inflation. Demand pull inflation is created by the consumer flush with too much money. That is, too much money in relation to the output of goods and services. His demand for products and services, especially services where there is a shortage of labor, pulls up the prices. Tight money and fiscal restraints help reduce the amount of spending money the consumer has, And it is apparent that administration anti-inflation policies have worked in this area. The consumer has slowed down on his overall purchases. Witness the slump in color TV and automobile sales. However, the cost-push type of inflation has not cooled. Cost-push inflation is caused in part when unions win high wage contracts, and the manufacturers then must raise their prices to try and maintain profit margins. This year may bring the toughest labor bargaining in 10 years. The Teamsters Union is asking up to a 96% increase over 3 years in wages and fringe benefits for its 450,000 members. Construction workers have been averaging pay hikes of about 15% a year. And this spring, 400,000 of these workers will be seeking wage increases, along with 70,000 rubber workers. To some, these wage demands are the chief inflation villain, but not to Nat Goldfinger, research director of the AFL-CIO.
The noted Yale University economist, James Tobin, said there's no question that excessive labor costs add fuel to inflation. But if you want to put first things first, have a look at the role of profits. And we in the trade union movement believe that one of the difficulties at present in viewing inflation is that first things have not been put first. Now let's look at the record of the 1960s. During the 1960s, corporate profits shot up sharply, much faster than wages and salaries. In the first half of 1969, corporate profits after taxes were up 93% from 1960 in that period of 9.5 years. But in that same period of time, the after-tax weekly earnings of the average non-supervisory worker were up only 34%, three-fifths less than profits. Moreover, in terms of buying power, the gain was only 10%. During the second half of 1969, profits dipped slightly under the impact of the government's very tight money policy and the highest interest rates in over 100 years. While the buying power of the average worker's weekly take-home pay remained the same, with no increase at all. So that in terms of looking at first things first, we think that the present inflation is largely a profit inflation.
Although inflation continues to rise even as our economy levels off, there is one area where deep deflation already has taken place: Wall Street. Market analysts generally estimate about $200 billion have been lopped off the value of stocks since last summer's highs. Robert Allen, vice president in charge of research for Sherson Hamill, analyzes inflation's effect on the stock market.
To some extent, it's been a casualty, and in another sense, it's been a tool. I think it's highly intentional on the part of the government to, as one part of its anti-inflation program, to work through the medium of the stock market and hope to deflate, at least partially, consumer spending attitudes that way. A number of people who are investors, after all, we have something like 30 million of them these days, tend to measure how well off or how badly off they feel when they have a lot of paper profits in their stock portfolios. They feel pretty good and pretty well able to go out and buy a new car or buy a new house. And the opposite of that is true in a period such as we went through in 1969 and are still going through currently. I think you can see it in the University of Michigan survey and other surveys of consumer spending attitudes, that intentions to buy consumer durable goods, automobiles, major appliances, housing, and so forth, have taken a major dive in the last several months.
In the light of the stock market's decline, Mr. Allen considers the question of whether or not the market is a good hedge against inflation.
It's true that prices have gone up over the years, prices of goods and services. It's also true that stock prices have gone up over the years. And I think people connect these up to the effect that the stock market is a good hedge against inflation. I think in a period where inflation is occurring at a very modest rate, such as we had in the 1950s and the early part of the 1960s, where the rate of inflation is around 1 or 2% a year, the stock market is prospers in that kind of a climate. There's enough of a inflationary tinge so that people are very interested in staying even with the cost of living by investing in the stock market. And yet there's not such a bad inflationary tinge to the economy that the government feels constrained to do something major about it as they have in the last few years. I think you can also look at the experience of many European countries as another way of proving this, that as rates of inflation in other major economic countries in the world, Europe and Japan, as the rate of inflation has increased, stock prices have fallen on bad times. When the rate of inflation is low and relatively stable, that's usually a good period for the stock market. There's no question that people want to hedge against inflation and probably should try it in the stock market, because if you're right on stock prices and the market is with you for a period of time, and you're right in your selection of companies, you should make enough money to leave the increasing consumer prices well in the dust.
There are many financial experts who believe the government has attacked the inflation problem in the wrong way. Among them is Samuel Greenfield.
The wrong people are being attacked. The entire policy of the administration is to, in some way, restrict the consumer area of the economy. There's no evidence at all that the consumer area of the economy is causing the inflation. It is the area of government spending which is causing the inflation. Way back in 1929, and all of these figures are available in a report just issued by the President of the United States. It's a report, it's the financial report of the President of the Congress. And anybody can get it by writing to the Superintendent of Documents and paying $1.50. In 1929, something like 8% of the gross national product was spent by cities, state, and federal government, with the federal government spending an almost insignificant 1 or 1.25%. By 1969, this 8% rose to 23%. The federal government, the cities, and the states spent in the neighborhood of $200 billion of the gross national product, or 23%. Now, that $200 billion must be added on to the cost of doing business, because that's all going to be passed on, that all has been passed on to the consumer. Now, you may argue that we need that. I'm not raising that question. I don't raise the moral question here. I'm merely saying that is the cause of your inflation and not the consumer buying. The percentage of consumer buying in 29 is the same as it was in 69. The percentage of business construction in 29 is approximately the same as it was in 69. That has been a constant percentage of the gross national product. But the spending by city, state, and federal governments has mushroomed disproportionately. There's your cause for the inflation. And that's why I believe very strongly that the policies of the federal government, the tight money policies, is a wrong policy. It's a disastrous policy. It has led to destruction of, if I said, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of goods, of money, in terms of bonds and common stocks. I think I would be very conservative.
Our inflation today is the worst since the Korean War in 1951. We had wage and price controls then, and it's been suggested that if inflation continues to spiral, we might need controls again, but not in the opinion of Professor Milton Friedman.
I don't believe wage and price controls are the answer to this problem. Because that's like, if your house is too hot, breaking the thermometer and saying, the thermometer always registers 70. That doesn't do you a bit of good if the furnace is going full blast down below. Well, the same thing is true with wage and price controls. The rising wages and prices are a symptom of inflation, not a cause of inflation. They reflect the fact that the furnace is going full blast. To declare wages and prices shall not rise, simply suppresses the pressure. It creates, and it tends to come out somewhere else. This is not a new thing. As far back as 2,000 years ago, at the time of Emperor Diocletian, there was a famous edict of Diocletian in which, in order to stop inflation, he passed a law saying that no price and no wage should rise. That edict failed. There was great turmoil, but wages and prices went right through the ceiling, and they did rise illegally, if not legally. in the 2,000 years since then, wage and price controls have been tried over and over again, and they have never worked. So that wage and price controls are not only not an answer, they make the matters far worse.
Professor Friedman doesn't always agree with another distinguished colleague, Professor Samuelson of MIT. Both professors have been mentioned as a possible choice for the Nobel Prize in Economics. But on the subject of controls, Professor Samuelson's views parallel Professor Friedman's.
The easiest thing in the world for me as an economist to recommend would be, let's have wage and price controls. Now, I believe that wage and price controls are terribly effective, but I think they're terribly effective in the short run. After a year or two, they begin to spring leaks and they become inequitable, and so let's save them, I've thought, for a real emergency, much worse than what we now have.
Dr. Walter Heller was chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors during both the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. Now he is a professor of economics at the University of Minnesota. Although he is not for controls, Dr. Heller favors wage and price guidelines, guideposts that enable an administration to jawbone or talk against sharp wage and price increases. Dr. Heller doesn't agree with the administration's decision to abandon these guidelines.
This is the time to reintroduce the concept of wage-price guideposts to get at the malfunctioning of markets where there is market power being exercised against the public interest. And for all its warts, for all its deficiencies, I think that's an instrument the government should not have thrown away and that I hope it will come back to. It's the greatest single omission in the Nixon anti-inflationary policy.
Still another opinion from John Kenneth Galbraith, political activist, former ambassador to India, author, one-time head of the Americans for Democratic Action, and a professor of economics at Harvard. Professor Galbraith thinks the lack of wage and price controls has spurred inflation.
The main reason has been the uncontrolled wage increases bringing uncontrolled price increases and these acting on each other, and the unwillingness of the administration to come to grips with this problem. If they were determined to do so, as other industrial countries are, they could have removed the main cause of inflation, but there are deep theological objections on the part of the Republican administration to touching wages and prices, and that is indeed the main practical reason why we have these large price increases. Other industrial countries have taken the matter in hand and have a wage, price, or incomes policy. Sooner or later, we will do the same.
You've heard from economic experts and people about the causes and effects of inflation and ways of solving the problem. These authorities and others in and out of government state their views on the outcome. Professor Milton Friedman.
I think it may well be that we are going to have a more severe recession than would have been necessary because the monetary authorities were so anxious to slow down inflation and had insufficient patience so that they stepped on the brake too hard. We have tried to halt this inflation. We may have tried to halt it too fast.
Professor Paul A. Samuelson.
I do not expect to see price stability in the next 5 years. I've been reading the Nixon economic report, and it's evident to me that they do not have any magic medicine which will roll back the price inflation, which will create price stability, and give us full employment. We have an uneasy compromise between having something less than full employment and having something less than price stability. We shall do well, in my opinion, if we hold the rate of price increase down to, let's say, 3.5%. This is not what I'm saying is my preference, but this is what I think we're going to have. And if we keep the unemployment rate from rising above 4.5%.
Paul McCracken, chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors.
During the first half of the year, real output would increase much less than potential output, and it might even decline. This would set the stage for reductions of the rate of inflation in the second half of the year, although demand and real output were then rising more strongly. By the fourth quarter of 1970, the rate of inflation, as measured by the GNP deflator, might be in the 3 to 3.5% zone, compared to over 5% in 1969.
Professor Saulnier, chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under President Eisenhower.
In order to have a good, secure kind of a situation with the kind of growth we want, we can't have too much confidence. We do have to somehow shake the feeling that inflation is here, it's going to stay, it may even get worse, and the whole psychology which is based on that. That must be shaken. If that is not shaken, there will be no correction of this problem.
Dr. Pierre Rinfrey.
In the economic report of the president, the administration says that you're not going to do your maximum for the next 3 years. 1970, 1971, we can produce 4.5% more a year. They're going to keep it down to 2. In 1972, the election year, of course, they're going to get the growth rate back to 5%. Now, Jim Knowles of the Joint Economic Committee and Economic Report put this very well. He said this is the first five-year plan in which 3 years are going to be a recession. But the answer is very simple. The economy is going to be kept suppressed and repressed for another 2 years, and by that time you will solve part of the inflation problem.
Dr. Walter Heller, chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson.
The Nixon-Burns team won't let things go from bad to worse. I think they have an overriding political and human interest, and that leads me in part to the conviction that this slowdown is self-limiting, but it's also based on very strong underlying economic forces that persuade me that this is really a pause in a long-term uptrend and not the petering out of a long cycle.
Dr. Arthur Burns, now chairman of the Federal Reserve Board.
We're paying the price now for letting inflationary developments build up ahead of steam over the past 5 years. By the end of 1969, however, we had succeeded in eliminating the excess demand for goods and services that has been at the root of our inflationary problem. We must now have the patience to wait for the improvement in price performance that will eventually result.
Dr. Arthur Burns, whom we just heard, views our economy from his vital post as the new chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. He can look with some satisfaction at what appears to be the preliminary success of the administration's plan to cool one of the most stubborn inflationary periods of recent history. The Commerce Department reports in its latest figures that the index of leading economic indicators has taken a sharp drop. The classical economic applications of monetary and fiscal restraint are paying off. The economy has stopped growing, and unemployment has increased. Some smaller banks have cut their prime lending rate by 0.5%. There has not been a slowdown in spending for capital outlays, but the slowdown has affected defense spending, housing, consumer durables, and non-residential construction. As some of our economists have said, the increase in capital spending this year is the big prop holding up the economy. It also is keeping interest rates high. But if capital spending starts to decline, it could trigger a full-scale recession. And if we should go into a recession, there will still be complaints about rising prices. For history shows that inflation doesn't stop at the same time a recession begins. The critical question now is, have we overstayed restraints to stop inflation? If we have, how deep will the recession be? No one knows precisely the answer to this question, because economics is an inexact science. In fact, there are those who maintain it is no science at all. But we do know that with our myriad domestic problems and social unrest, no administration can afford a recession that would create dangerous levels of unemployment. As a matter of fact, the Full Employment Act of 1946 says, in effect, no administration can stand by when unemployment rises to harmful levels. Therefore, the administration is watching all the economic indicators very carefully. It seems ready now to accept a slight expansion of the money supply. The Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis warns of the dangers of a policy of waiting to see the whites of the eyes of the inflation enemy. Along with some easing of the money growth by the Federal Reserve, the administration is loosening fiscal restraints. It is putting more than $10 billion extra dollars into circulation through higher Social Security payments, higher wages for government employees, and dropping the surtax. But it is not the intention of the Nixon administration to panic and pump huge supplies of money into the economy. This would start the inflationary cycle all over again. The president's economic report states that the plan is for the economy to grow at a flat, non-inflationary rate for the next 2 years or so. And though this may disappoint the speculators who thrive on a boom and bust cycle, if the plan works, it will impart an era of stability to our economy, building the base for future sustained and orderly growth. And all of us will be able to budget our incomes without the anxiety of seeing the value of our dollar fade away.
The sound of money, the lovely sound of money, I find it quite appealing, a feeling you may share.
You have been listening to Inflation, the Economic Plague.